This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, along with my producer, Lee Della Pina, and ready to spend the next hour, as we do each and every Wednesday evening, talking with some of the people that help make this sport go. And of course, for those of you who tune in every week, you know I'm talking about the trainers. 365 days a year, it can be a very rewarding job, and it can be a bit of a grind at times as well. We have heard vast differences in the stories of how each and every trainer got their start and how they've gotten to the point that they are at today with their career, and looking forward to our visit coming up here tonight. Going to be joined in the first half of the show by trainer Brian Lynch, born in Brisbane, Australia. 379 career winners for a career that is still ongoing and going strong. His runners have earned more than $19 million in purses, and yes, he will celebrate his 50th birthday 2 days before the run for the Roses. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with us tonight. And, you know, it's interesting. Ian Wilkes, the only other Australian-born trainer to appear on this show thus far. Did you grow up in the same area as Ian?
Ironically, Ian and I grew up about 30 minutes away from each other and played football against each other when we were kids. You could probably only remember the soles of my boots as I was running away from him.
Now, Australian football, different than what we're talking about here in the United States.
Yeah, more of the rugby type football.
Who was better, you or Ian?
I'd say I've got Ian on that one.
Yeah, well, he's just big into the golf now, so I think you drove him out of football. He's strictly focusing on golf.
I always tell him, you've got to remember what Mark Twain says about golf, ruins a good walk.
So when you were growing up and getting to know Ian and hanging out with him in your native Australia, was it something that you both talked about, being involved with horse racing and training horses at some day?
Yeah, I sort of grew up around a little town called Wagga Wagga, and Ian come from a little town about 30 minutes away. So as far as our involvement with horses together as kids, that was sort of non-existent. But I always was involved, sort of come from a humble sort of background, and for pocket money, kids had earned money over at the track, filling water buckets, walking coal ones. So that's where I sort of cut my teeth and quickly graduated into galloping horses. So that's where I got my start.
What was it about the sport that first captured you and first appealed to you?
Just the animals. I've always been an animal lover, and I was actually, my dear old dad would always say I was a funny kid growing up. You could ask me at any stage what I was going to be. You know, I was never going to be a fireman or a policeman. I was always going to be a horse trainer. So it's, I guess I've been lucky to go through life and have a job that I've had a passion for. So, like you said, it's a 365-day-a-year job, and I always say the best part about it, we get to do it every day.
Yeah, you get to do it every day, and the story I hear from a lot of trainers that have appeared on this program is that it can be a bit of a grind at times, but the highs that we experience with a good horse that comes into your barn or a big stakes win, it really makes up for a lot of the times that you're putting in the effort and doing the things behind the scenes that people don't often see, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, the business has got two levels, highs and lows, and you know, obviously the injury side of things, and that really affects us and them, but it seems to get pushed to the back when you win a big stake or you know, you've got a nice two-year-old starting to reveal himself, or a good three-year-old coming to himself, for sure.
So you mentioned starting off with walking hots and carrying water buckets, much like a lot of trainers do when they're getting to know the game and getting to be around it. Who were some of the people that kind of helped you get started and ultimately gave you your big break to go out on your own?
Well, I sort of grew up, like I said, in a real rural sort of setting, a lot of cattle, a lot of horses, and I started training, just working around the yard, as we call it back there in Australia, and with a couple of, who I still to this day think were great horsemen, because they just taught you the fundamentals of livestock, what to look for and how to read them and feed them well and keep them happy. And I still think that they taught me some of the golden lessons in this business. And I rode horses as much as a kid could ride horses when I was younger, and galloped every morning before school and went to the stable straight after and mucked out and fed and done all the afternoon chores. I would love to have been a jockey, but was always going to be a bit big. So I always graduated onto riding the rougher horses or the pullers or the breakers, and I broke an enormous amount of horses. And I got interested in the rodeo circuit. So a bit like Carl Nasker, was a young bull rider way back when, and that's what brought me to the States. I was on the pro tour circuit over here for about 5 to 7 years, but always had a passion for the racehorses. So as that started to wind down, I was living in Southern California, I was reading the California Thoroughbred magazine, and I seen where a farm called Suncoast Thoroughbred Farms were looking for someone to pre-train and break. I replied to that number, and the guy said to me, "Have you got any references?" I said, "Not really, but I've grown up around livestock my whole life, if you just let me come down and we do a bit of an interview, I'm sure we can sort something out." So I think when he got to see me get out of the car and see my bow legs, he knew I had something to do with horses, and I got the job. So I started off on the very furthest remote corner of California and the Pacific Coast, and right above me was the Tijuana. So you can see the lights of Tijuana. So I started breaking horses there. Old Caliente was still in progress, and the guy's name was Wayne Sperling. He used to be a leading trainer at Caliente, but he was an American who had a little small farm on the, like I said, the most remote corner. It was absolutely fantastic, because I'd break them colts and I'd just go and ride them on the beach down there.
Anyway,
I picked up a small owner from there, a guy who lived in Las Vegas called Richard Tam. And if anybody ever goes to UNLV there, you'll see there's a Richard Tam alumni there. He's a very wealthy old entrepreneur from there and had a handful of mares. I was able to snaggle him as a first client. And I took a trainer's test at Del Mar. I annoyed the stewards there until they eventually gave me a license. I got a couple of pens. I'll never forget them. We were just talking about them this morning. I got a couple of Pipe Corral pens there at Del Mar. And I had two horses of my own, and that's where it got started.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And going back for just a minute to what you said about being a bull rider, and that's what brought you to the United States, not so much the horse racing aspect, but you know, being a bull rider. You mentioned Carl Nasker. He was on the show about a year ago, Brian, and he talked about his career as a bull rider. He loves to talk about that aspect of it. Did you know Carl at all when you came to the States, or did you seek him out knowing that he was doing something that you always wanted to do, and that was training horses as well?
Well, I lived with a family in Central California. A guy's name was Gary LeFou, and he was a world champion bull rider, and he's probably still to this day one of the gurus of the sport as far as teaching young guys the mechanics and the mental philosophy on how to, you know, because obviously it's tough enough to get on them big high horn Bramer crossbred things, let alone be able to handle it mentally, because they can be very intimidating. And Gary was always a guru of positive thinking and how to overcome your fears and that sort of stuff. But so to cut a long story short, his traveling buddy way back in 1970s, the late 60s, when he was rodeoing, was Carl Nasker. and Gary always used to tell me about, because, you know, I still through that period always talked about racehorses, always if we were anywhere near a track, whether it be Golden Gate or Old Bay Meadows back then or Santa Anita, I'd always swing in and go to the races for the afternoon. And so Gary always told me about this old travelling buddy of his, Carl Nasker. So as time went on, I, again, ironically, Ian, who grew up 30 minutes, become like a son to Carl, and it's an amazing connection. So me and Carl still to this day, I've seen him this morning. Every time I see him, I always refer to him as the old bull rider.
Yeah, I think he loves when people do that too. He's, of course, in the Bull Riding Hall of Fame and in, of course, the Horse Racing Hall of Fame as a trainer as well. So it's a pretty cool story.
There you go. He's quite a talented man to be able to achieve both Hall of Fames.
Yeah, it always gets me when I talk to people like Carl and you know, being somebody that has never really even ridden a horse, forget about riding, you know, bulls for a living. But I talked to so many jockeys, and they talk about the number of injuries they sustained and the broken bones and all that kind of stuff that they have to overcome through their career. I can assume with bull riding, that's no picnic either, is it?
Well, I was very lucky, and I always say the easiest part about that is riding them. The hard part's getting off them and getting away from them. So I think back, and, you know, we used to do an amazing, I think we would, the association would allow us to do 126 qualifying rodeos a year. So you calculate the numbers on how many bulls you get on over a time, you know, over your career, and then there's the practice pens and, you know, there's an enormous amount of livestock there. And I was always very lucky. Obviously, you're going to mess with the bull. You're going to get a bit of snot blown down the back of your shirt and a horn stuck in places you wish it wasn't and jumped on. But I never really did get injured. I think I often got a scrape and a scratch. I think I broke an ankle once. It was about the worst injury I ever had, and it wasn't a bad break.
So well, you're very fortunate.
I consider myself very lucky to, you know, the amount of miles I traveled to get to them rodeos and cars and trains and planes and then to get on top of them things to be able to walk away with the memories I have. I always used to describe it as the endless fiesta. It was a great party.
Yeah, no doubt. You're very, very fortunate. So let's fast forward just a little bit here, Brian. By the way, talking with Brian Lynch on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Your first winner comes with a quarter horse, if I'm not mistaken, at Roseburn Parkland.
I don't know where that come from. I never did train quarter horses.
Really?
I don't know where. Some people have said that to me before. No,
yeah.
I started at Del Mar, and my first horse was a winner at Hollywood Park. The horse name was Arcs of Flying. I still remember it, yeah.
Okay, all right. So no quarter horses for Brian Lynch.
No.
Now, with Hollywood Park closing, was that more solemn for you because of that special moment you had with that first winner coming at Hollywood?
Yeah, well, I got a lot of fond memories. Just went home to Australia for Christmas and called into Hollywood Park to watch the cash call, the last grade one there, and had 2 days there. And I trained at Hollywood for about 15 years before I came out to the East Coast and was primarily based at Hollywood Park and, you know, Del Mar during the summer, obviously, but yeah, got some wonderful memories of Hollywood Park. Great training facility. You know, some of the, you know, Charlie was still around there. Willard Proctor was there. Obviously, Bobby was, you know, based there. And I always feel that when I first started there, you know, I've always had a bit of a philosophy. If you're going to get good at something, surround yourself by the best in the business and try to pick up what you can. And I was very lucky. I always think the three men I admire most I'm still to this day great friends with Jack Bamberg and Ron McAnally. Still talk to both of them on a regular basis. And I was lucky enough to be, you know, a lot of people think I worked for Bobby Frankel for quite a while, but I never did really. We were just best friends for 15 years. And so I had the luxury of having my three good buddies, McAnally, Frankel, and Bamberg. So I used to hang out with them three, and I used to take them to a little English pub in Santa Monica called the King's Head, and all four of us would sit down, and we'd have these great breakfasts, and at the end of them, Jack would say, well, God damn, we've known each other for 25 years and we've congratulated each other on our wins, but it takes this crazy Aussie to get us together and have such fun times, because we did. I wish to have it on video, like I said. Bobby asking Jack about Ali Sheba, Jack asking Bobby how he come up through them claiming ranks, and Ronnie talking about John Henry, Bayer Carl Park. You know, it was just fantastic memories.
Yeah, that's one heck of a training trifecta. Jack Van Berg, yeah. Ron McAnally, Bobby Frankel. Not many people have the opportunity to sit down and talk with those three in a casual setting like that, or really any setting. Nobody really had that opportunity. Very few people anyways, and you did. You're very fortunate.
Very fortunate. And like I said, to this day, I still talk to Ronnie on a regular basis. And Jack, I always feel like if I learned three things from each of them, Bobby was always a guy that made you pay attention to detail. It's them small things that matter. And so if I picked up anything from him, he was just, you know, the ultimate in picking up things and being ahead of the game. And McAnally, I felt like that, you know, if I learned something from Ronnie, it was good horses work good going into good races. And, you know, so if you've got a horse and he's doing really good and he's coming up to a big race and he works three quarters and 10 and change, then take it as a good thing because he's doing well. And I always felt that Jack taught me that they all don't have to be the perfect horse. They all don't have to be this correct, perfect horse, because I've seen him do so much with horses that were turned in, towed out, back at the knees, sickle hop, sway back, you know. So if I feel like I can learn a little bit from each of them, that's what I feel like I've taken away from them.
Yeah, isn't that amazing how each one successful at the highest level of the sport, but it sounds like they each had different things that they keyed on throughout their career. It wasn't just one thing that was synonymous between all three of those trainers.
Yeah, no, for sure. Bobby was he just had a foresight and just knew exactly how to work them horses going into races. He just had that sixth sense. And Ronnie just, done such a good job of getting his horses ready and, you know, had them as fit as they could be. And they identified themselves when they were going into good races when they were right off their work tab. So I'm very, very blessed to be able to have that period of time and still have that connection I have with them.
Well, Brian, I'm going to go out on a limb and see if this next little statistic is correct. But if I'm not mistaken, your first career stakes win came at Del Mar, August 2nd of 1995, a horse by the name of Riva Ranger in the graduation stakes. Is that right?
Yeah, never forget that, for sure.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day? That's pretty cool.
Well, it was. It was by Video Ranger out of a Riva Ridge mare. And it was a fantastic day, but also a very sad day, because after the race, he unfortunately shattered a sesamoid and he had to be euthanized. So it was, again, the highs and lows of the sport. I was so excited to have a stakes winner on the big stage at Del Mar. But I was brokenhearted. I was just starting to get going, and the best horse I had, you know, I think he'd only had two or three starts, that horse, undefeated, and to win a stake like that and then actually have to be put down after the race was a real heart jerker and an eye-opener to the years that were ahead of me, learning how to handle the game.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's a horrible story, but we hear these types of stories, you know, from time to time, and this is a sport with the highest highs, with the lowest lows. You experienced that within a matter of minutes with that graduation stakes. How do you continue to focus and to persevere through those things? Is it difficult when something catastrophic like that occurs in your career?
Oh, I think that if it's not difficult, then you haven't got a heart. I mean, we get so attached to these animals, they become, you know, like our family members. But with a humane euthanasia and they're put to rest, and you've done the right thing by them, and you'll never forget them, but you try to move on. If there's anything that I felt like that I could have changed or I could have done differently to prevent that from happening, it's definitely something that'll never happen again with me, because I'll make that change or I'll look for that sign or something like that. So I mean, I hope to think that I grow and learn through them sort of things, and I don't think it'll ever, you'll ever prevent that sort of stuff. It's just the unfortunate nature of our beast. You do everything within your realm to make sure you're on top of that sort of thing, but, you know, it could be track conditions or whatever that that causes that sort of stuff, a bad step. They're big animals hitting at high speed on small joints. So, yeah, but, you know, you just got to pick your head up and move on.
Trainer Brian Lynch, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, Brian, so let's fast forward now. We go from Reva Ranger winning the graduation stakes, your first stakes win, and bridge the gap for me between that performance and that victory and then Ginger Brew, Sugar Swirl, Spring Waltz, all those types of horses.
Yeah, well, then I sort of, you know, at that stage, I didn't have too many horses in training in California, and I picked up a lovely client that I trained for years from that particular incident. His name was Ben Rochelle, and he got such great memories of him. He was such a wonderful man to train for, and he had the great Snow Chief back with Mel Studi in the day. He had Very Subtle, the first Breeders' Cup filly to beat the boys in the first sprint there. And so I end up picking up his horses, and I trained sort of very quietly, privately, for on a sort of private job for him for a good number of years later. And so I never did, had a real big stable, sort of just worked on developing young horses and buying horses out of the sales. And at that time, I was starting to move a few horses back and forth from Australia, selling them in Southern California. So, you know, staying alive in the business, or staying, you know, not going broke in the business was my primary goal at that stage, and getting miles on me. And eventually, you know, as I said, eventually Ben, you know, when he passed away, I thought, wow, you know, this is going to be tough from here. I lost my main guy, and I actually, John Mabey of Golden Eagle Farms was still alive, and John had called me and asked me would I take some two-year-olds for him, because he'd read a little blurb in the form that, you know, my main owner had passed, and that I was going public, and that, you know, I'd be accepting outside horses. So I was, it was just blessed to have him call me, and the next day a Golden Eagle van pulled up, and I think they gave me about 15 two-year-olds. So I had a wonderful, you know, four or five more years with them, and unfortunately Mr. Mabey died, and Bobby had always been at me to, you know, take a string for him and go out east, because he was starting to get big in on the East Coast, which he hadn't had a lot of horses out there in years gone by, because he's sort of concentrated on Southern California. And so I, you know, decided, well, he's probably right. You know, California Racing had just lost a few big breeders. That Mr. Mabey had died, and Walters had died, Mrs. Ritter had died. So there's a lot of brood mares that weren't going to be bred back. And I just felt like the horse population in California wasn't going to be that big, and it was going to be the stronger trainers who were going to probably get the majority of the horses. So I'd take the opportunity with Bobby, and I took a division for him in Saratoga. And I had, you know, a lot of the babies. Actually, me and Chad were together there.
Yep.
Chad Brown. And so cut a long story short, that winter I went to down here to Palm Meadows, which I've been, and I had Go Sapper in my division down there, and we were getting him ready for, he'd just won the Breeders' Cup, and he'd had some time off, and we were getting him ready to run him in the Oaklawn Handicap, and so throughout that period, I had quite a few horses for the Stronics were with him. We had the good three-year-old High Limit at the time, who hadn't ran since a two-year-old. We had just taken over Badger Silver, and so I had some nice horses in my division. And, you know, consequently, we sent Badger Silver and High Limit over to run them in the New Orleans Handicap and the Louisiana Derby that day. And, boy, they both won and both set track records. And so we were off to the races. We had a great winter that year with Bobby down here, and we unfortunately didn't make the Oaklawn Handicap with Go Sapper, because he had a sinus issue, and we had to drill his sinuses and flush him, and consequently got him ready for the Met Mile. And that's when he ran one of his best races ever. So from there, the Stronics sort of knew who I was, and Bobby approached me that they were interested and asked me to go up to Canada and train the division for them up there. And had a wonderful, 5 or 6 years training privately for Mr. Stronic and Mrs. Stronic there, and that's where we come across Ginger Swirl and Spring Waltz, and I'm sure there's quite a few more there that I haven't mentioned, but I really feel every day I look up and thank Frankel for talking me into leaving the West Coast and coming to the East Coast, because I was able to get established out there, out here, and I was able to get established in Canada. So it was, it was a great move.
Yeah, it's a who's who of thoroughbreds in this sport that you just walked through. I mean, from Ghost Sapper to Ginger Brew to Sugar Swirl, it's just absolutely amazing. And to have that opportunity had to be extremely special for you at that point in your career. And I can imagine when Bobby Frankel says, hey, we're going to go to the East Coast, as difficult as it was for you to leave the West Coast, you go. You don't even think twice, do you?
I didn't. I jumped on a plane with 26 of his horses the very next day and flew out to Saratoga, and he exposed me to some great owners who, I still train for the Ammermans, who were with Bobby for years and years, and they're a major part of my stable. And by having gone to Canada, I was able to fortunately hook up with Jim and Susan Hill, who are probably my main clients, and they, I believe we've built a great relationship, and I train a lot of horses for them, and I hope to continue to have a lot of success for them. And Stronics have gave me some horses back, so that's a great opportunity. Got a wonderful clientele. Had a great year this year as far as some sort of under the radar type horses. Clearly Now really panned out for me nicely this year, and Five Iron was a great surprise. He just kept getting better, and to win the Saranac at Saratoga this year was a great thrill for a great owner and Fred Haller. So yeah, it's been a great year.
Well, Brian, only about 1 minute left before we have to move on to the second half of the program, but I always like to end by asking trainers what it is they like to do when they're not at the racetrack. What other hobbies does Brian Lynch have when you're not at the track?
Well, one thing about this job, you're sort of married to it, but I certainly do. I've a wonderful significant other who helps me in the barn, Erin. She's my partner. I've got a 13-year-old son who lives there in Lexington, Nicholas. So, I spend a lot of time with him. I just took him home to Australia we're getting through the summer. I fish a lot. I like fishing. I play a bit of golf with Ian Wilkes. Wouldn't be as good as Ian, but I'd have made up with it as a football when we were younger. And I love horses. Even outside of the racetrack, I love to ride. I love just trail riding, pushing cattle. I just love horses. So
he's training Brian Lynch. Brian, can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us here tonight. Been great to hear your story, and we'll see if we can set up a rematch with you and Ian on the football field.
That'd be great. Take him on any day.
All right, thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. All the best moving forward.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
All right, Brian Lynch, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. Great stuff, the native of Brisbane, Australia. He's had some great highs and some lows as well, but still going strong. We'll get to the second half of Trainer Talk coming up next.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Phasic Tipton. Where will you be this summer? The Phasic Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The sale
sales $295,000 average in 2013, maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga, with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races. This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to. You can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the archives. All of our Trainer Talk shows available for you to listen to, all at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Fun visit in the first half of the program, and now looking ahead to trainer Brad Cox, who is going to join us here in the second half of the program. Grew up in the shadows of the Twin Spires in Louisville, Kentucky. He has 253 career winners to his credit. Those runners have earned just shy of $5 million in purses, and he joins us now here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with us here and looking forward to hearing your story. If I'm not mistaken, your love of racing spawns from a relationship with your dad. Is that right?
Yeah, he just took me to the track when I was a kid and, you know, started out with betting. Having him bet two to win on a horse for me here and there and, you know, nothing big. But just go over on the weekends. I grew up two blocks from Churchill Downs and just fell in love with it at a very early age. And I knew I wanted to be involved in it, just not, you're not sure, you know, what aspect or quite what I wanted to do. But when I was in high school, I kind of decided I wanted to start training horses. So,
well, being so close to Churchill, were you one of those people that rented out your yard for parking for Oaks and Derby Day?
Yeah, early on when I was probably 10 years old, yeah, I used to park cars like $10, $15 a car, and then, you know, as I got a little bit older and more involved in the horses, I was a little more worried about getting over to see the Derby, Oaks and Derby horses and stuff myself.
Yeah, I always wondered if people that charged to park and then would get everybody settled into their yard and then head over, take that money, head over and start betting the races.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's how people do it.
I can imagine growing up so close to Churchill, that's obviously the track you consider to be your home track. I'm sure it still is today. Did you get a chance to make it to Keeneland very much, or was it just Churchill?
Mostly Churchill. As as I got older, you know, I went, started going to all the tracks, Ellis, Keeneland, Turfway. I spent a lot of time at Turfway in the winters, you know. But, you know, all the Kentucky tracks. But, you know, obviously Churchill is home. That's my home track. It's where I, you know, get keyed up for now all three meets there in the past, just the spring and the fall. But now we have the September meet. So, you know, we try to get geared up and have, you know, big meets there.
Those, yeah, those, you know, it's always great to win races anywhere, but is it a little more special for you to win them beneath the Twin Spires at your home track?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think, you know, the obvious goal is, you know, someday to win the Derby. I mean, I think most people that do this kind of feel like there's a Derby out there with their name on it. I mean, I certainly do. So, you know, that's definitely the goal, someday to win the Derby. And that's the number one race for me, you know, as far as trying to win someday.
Yeah, I mean, obviously every trainer, and we've heard a lot of trainers say that here on the program, the trainers that have yet to win a Kentucky Derby, they say, well, that's the one thing on my bucket list that I want to do. How do you, Brad, what's your approach? How do you go about trying to find that Derby horse?
I have no clue right now. Just win races. I mean, that's the only thing I can tell you is just win races, whatever level that seems to attract owners, is just winning at whatever level and being competitive, not only winning, but being competitive. And, you know, obviously, you know, it's all about getting the horse, but, I don't think there's any special formula or a formula to getting a Derby winner. I think you just got to be in the right place at the right time and just, you know, a lot of luck involved as well.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that you knew that you always wanted to be around the sport and involved in the sport in some way. Take us back to the beginning. How did you eventually fall into horse racing and get started down that road to be a trainer?
Well, when I was in high school and stuff, and even middle school, you know, I would come over and muck stalls, walk hots before school, get out of school, come back, you know, as a swing groom in the afternoons after school. And then just, you know, as my junior and senior year of high school, I mean, I was ready to get out of school just so I could, you know, travel with the horses in the wintertime or whatever. And that's just decided, you know, I was aggressive and ambitious and wanted to, you know, I didn't want to be a groom or a high walker or, you know, obviously all my life. So I wanted to, take the next step. And that's what we did. Just, and I think in December of 2004, we went on our own.
So who was the first person to give you a break on the track and let you get involved?
I walked hots for Jinx Fires and Frankie Brothers when I was 14, 15 years old. And then when I was 16, I worked for Jimmy Baker for a few years and then worked for Dallas Stewart for about 4.5 years.
Well, that's a pretty good group to learn from. I can imagine Frankie and Jinx just being around their operations and seeing how they did things. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Frankie and Jinx both probably had different approaches to training horses, but maybe some similarities there as well, weren't there?
Yeah. I mean, they're all good horsemen. They were, you know, I mean, I can remember being young and, you know, Frankie Brothers teach me how to, you know, just walk horses and the proper way to put a shank on. And attention to detail was a big thing. I mean, all those guys were, you know, there's a right way and there's a wrong way. And, you know, you pick up on a lot of small, subtle things from each guy that, you know, really tailor your horsemanship, I guess you could say. But even like with Dallas, I mean, when I was with Dallas, I had some very, very nice horses. Having an opportunity to be around Umbrella Dulane, we had Dollar Bill in the Derby, Nasty Storm in the Oaks. We had some decent horses, so.
Yeah, so
you've gotten a lot from good horses, for sure.
Yeah, so you've gotten a taste of what it's like to be at the Oaks, at the Derby, and saddling a runner in those races. It just wasn't the runner you were training, necessarily.
Right. Yeah, no, I wasn't. Obviously, my name wasn't in the program, but, yeah, I've been through the whole Oaks and Derby thing and the Breeders' Cup thing, and it's exciting, to say the least. It gets your adrenaline going.
You know, I read a quote, Brad. By the way, Brad Cox joining us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I read a quote where you said that when Dallas worked for Wayne Lucas, Wayne would say he was going he was going, meaning Dallas was going to the University of Wayne Lucas. So Dallas always told you that you were going to the University of Dallas Stewart. What was it like being enrolled in that university?
It was good. I mean, Dallas is intense. I mean, you know, we had some very, very nice horses, and you know, it was a good program to learn. I mean, I remember one winter at the fairgrounds. I mean, you know, we had a lot of horses down there one winter. I think we had maybe 55 horses in like 4 or 5 different barns. I mean, got to see a lot. So it was you didn't miss out. I mean, you got to see plenty with all the horses, different types of horses, and you know, that's the whole thing. You need to be around a lot of horses and see a lot of different things.
So Dallas was your last job before you actually ended up going out on your own?
Yes, yes.
And what year was that?
I went on my own in December of 2004.
And was that with Dallas's encouragement, or do you just say, hey, Dallas, you've taught me a lot. I need to go do this on my own now?
Yeah, I'd spent the last couple of years I was with Dallas. I had a string on my own at Ellis. I was stable to Churchill, but we shipped Ellis. And we had really, really good, we had some really good summers there. There was a filly named Maltovita that, Dallas train that I was running at Ellis, and I created a friendship or a relationship with John Gunther that owned her, and he told me if you want to go on your own, he'd send me some horses, and I had some horses for him off the bat, and I guess that winter, or maybe the next spring, I probably had 8 horses for John Gunther. He kind of gave me my start.
So what are some of the things that you took away from working with Dallas and Frankie and Jinx and Jimmy Baker that you're still incorporating into your operation today?
Just about, I guess with all those guys, the one thing is you needing to be there, being around the barn a lot, you know, coming back in the afternoons, not just being here in the mornings, but coming back in the afternoons and you know, getting here and on time and just, you know, trying to see every horse train every day. And that's probably the biggest thing, because all those guys are like that.
So when you finally branch out on your own, what was your first career winner, and what do you remember about that day?
December 4th, 2004. I remember very well. It was Turfway Park. Joe Johnson rode the filly. I'd ran her at Churchill. She ran at Churchill a few weeks before that. And then I believe she ran in like an open 10, and she still was a never win 3. And I kind of run her over her head a little bit at Churchill. Not really over her head, but it wasn't the right spot because the race wouldn't go. And it was my second start of my career, and she won. And I can't remember what she paid. I want to say she paid maybe $18. But Joe Johnson rode her. And that was when the strike was going on. I don't know if you remember that, but there was a jockey strike that fall. And a lot of the jocks wasn't riding, and I ended up with Joe Johnson, and he rode her great. I mean, he swung wide and got up for the win at Turfway.
Yeah, from your tone, it sounds like you were disappointed that you ended up with Joe. But yeah, he did pretty well for you.
Yeah, it was a big day.
Did you bet on the horse?
No, I didn't. I did not. No, no, I did not. She just got up to win by a head. I did not bet on her.
I can imagine there was a pretty good party in Louisville that night, or at least in northern Kentucky.
Yeah. And in fact, there was a lot of friends and family in the wind pitcher, so it was good.
Yeah, how many phone calls, text messages, things like that did you receive afterwards?
A lot. It was amazing because it was like, you know, I just started training and the first winter came so quick, but it was cool. It was really neat.
So you mentioned one term as you were describing that story. You said spotting horses, and that's a term that we hear used a lot, especially with trainers, certainly, because that's how they become successful. Talk about how you've learned to spot your horses and put them in the right positions, and what goes into that, Brad?
Well, we claim a lot of horses. I mean, you know, we're trying to go to the sales a lot more now as well, but it's all about, you know, claiming horses and giving the owner an opportunity to make money with them. I think that has a lot to do with it, and spotting them in the right place and you know, running where they're going to be competitive and have a chance to make money. You know, if you're running a horse and you're 30 to, if you run a group of horses, say 10 horses, and you're 30 to 1 with all of them, chances are at the end of the month, you're not going to pay many bills with those horses. So it's all about running them where they can compete and make money, and trying to make money, put it that way.
Was that a big learning curve?
An opportunity to succeed.
Yeah, was that a big learning curve for you when you first started out?
I think so, because when you first start out, you're kind of worried about getting your numbers up, you know, instead of having, you know, when I started out, I had 6 horses, 8 horses, and kind of fluctuated between those, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 horses. And, you know, you're kind of worried about, you know, losing horses, I guess, and running horses and them getting claimed and stuff. But at the end of the day, I think you have to win. You got to keep these owners going and happy, and you know, financially, the horses need to be paying for themselves. So, that's kind of the way I feel. You know, you just got to run them where they can compete and then make some money.
Well, you know, you've had such a good run. Obviously, you're doing something right. You're learning how to spot your horses, put them in the right positions, because the last 4 or 5 years have just been really, really strong for you. Wins continue to increase. The purse earnings continuing to go up, which means you're winning more of the right races. Talk about these last 4 or 5 years and what the key to success has been.
Well, I guess 4 years ago, I picked up Midwest Thoroughbreds, and I had about a 7-month stint with them, and learned a tremendous amount dealing with them as far as, you know, turning horses over, you know, claiming a lot of horses. I mean, obviously, I claimed before I was hooked up with Midwest, but not, you know, obviously when I started training for Midwest, I mean, it was just a lot more volume. You know, instead of claiming one horse a week, I was claiming 2 horses a day. So, you know, that you learn a ton from dealing with a bit large outfit like that. And, you know, I feel like a lot of my success right now is because of them and, you know, what I learned dealing with them and, seeing just having a lot of horses, you know, having 40, 50 horses at a time. So, you know, and horses come and they go. So that had a lot to do with, I think, the success now. And then, I had another stint with them where I worked for them for 1.5 years, and, you know, it was successful. I felt like it was successful. And once again, you know, turned over a lot of horses, and I think we claimed a filly, my Irish girl, for them for $15,000, won $100,000 stake at, Monmouth with her, and had some other claims that were very successful with them as well. So
yeah, it was a great partnership, and of course that relationship eventually came to an end. Is that something that when that happened, you look back on it and you said, oh man, I'm in trouble now, or was it you said, hey, I have the momentum already, I have my name out there, let's go forward?
Yeah, no doubt. That's kind of how you got to look at it. You have to look at it like that. It stings a little bit when you have 35 horses and you wake up and you're down to two horses. But, you know, I think that's just part of being on the racetrack. A lot of people, you have to be a really, really resilient person, and you have to be tough, and, you know, things happen one day, and, you know, you never know where a good horse is going to come from. You just got to get up and just keep doing it every day. And now, to be honest with you, I was never scared. I mean, I always feel like we're going to succeed and win races, and you just got to keep doing it. So,
talk about, Brad, some of the owners that you're involved with now that are kind of helping you get to where you want to get to.
What's that again, Mike?
Talk about some of the owners that you have that you're training for right now that are helping you, and you're also helping them get to where they want to get to.
Yeah, right now, most of my owners are in the claiming game. They like to claim horses and turn horses over and, you know, win races. That's kind of what they, you know, that's what, when they come to me, they say, you know, we want to win races. We don't want to lose money, you know, and there's going to be horses they lose money on. There's going to be horses they make money on. But at the end of the day, I mean, they're not in it to make money, but they're in it. They do treat it like a business, and they that's the name of the game, is to win races and try to at least break even for most of my clients.
Yeah, and let's face it, the claiming game is totally different than playing at the higher levels. It's a different philosophy. And I've talked to several trainers on this program that make their living in the claiming ranks. And from your perspective, what's your philosophy when you're looking to claim horses, and what's your ultimate goal?
Well, number one is, When you're claiming a horse, where are you going to run it before you even get it? I mean, are you going to have an opportunity to run the horse back? Once you get the horse, you know, you evaluate the horse, make some changes if needed. But the main thing is, you know, regardless what you're claiming, you want to make sure you're gonna be able to run it back, in say a month, 3 weeks, whenever it may be. It's tough to claim horses and not get to run them back for, you know, 2 or 3 months. That's when it starts, you know, because, you know, time is money. And, you know, you take a $10,000 horse, and if you don't run him for 3 months, all of a sudden the owner's got $16,000 in him, and it gets expensive, put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because owners that are playing in that particular part of the game, they don't want their horses laid up for a long period of time, because it does get very expensive.
Yes, yep.
So one term we hear a lot is, we'll hear that trainers are very good at moving horses up off a claim, where they'll claim a horse, maybe his form isn't the greatest, and then all of a sudden it goes to a new barn, and bang, the horse becomes pretty good, or at least right. Better than he was before. I always considered that kind of an art form. Is it? Is that right?
It's an art form, I guess, when it works and when you move one up. But I don't know. I mean, there's horses that we've done very well with. I mean, right now we've got a couple in our barn, Miss Anna Destiny and Point to the Wild. They're mares that we've claimed that we've done very well with over the last few months or last year. But, you know, there's a lot of horses that we've claimed that, you know, yeah, we do okay with them, but we don't even move them up. We just say maintain them, and we're able to maybe we may lose them a month after we claim them for a little more money than we claimed them for, and may run second or third. So at the end of the day, yeah, the owner made a couple bucks with them, but, you know, it varies from horse to horse. It really, really does. I mean, you know, we had a horse this year we claimed for 14. We lost it for 25,000, and he picked up, he had 2 seconds and some decent races. The owners made money with him, and they never got a picture taken with him. So,
yeah.
You know, it depends. You know, all of them are different. One size doesn't fit all, for sure, with these horses.
Talking with trainer Brad Cox on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, Brad, let me ask you a two-part question. The horse that you would say you have done your best work with would be which horse, and why would that be the case? And then we'll flip it around and say the horse you'd like to have back that you said, boy, if I had just done it this way, maybe we could have, things would have been different. How about those two?
What's that, Mike?
No, go ahead.
I feel like one of the better horses we've had since we've been training is Temple Street. It's a filly we claimed for $15,000, and she won a couple of lounge races for us, and she was second in a grade one at Churchill, the Humana Distaff. She's the one horse that I thought, I mean, she was just a very, very tough filly. I mean, she won a couple lounge races at Oaklawn. She was second in the Humana Distaff, which was a grade one. She was third in the Fleur de Lis at Churchill in the spring. I think her last race, she was fifth in the $1 million Delaware handicap. She was the toughest horse I've ever had, without a doubt. The horse I would like to have back. I don't know. I need more time to think about that one, to be honest.
it's a tough question.
I can't really give you a horse right now that I would like to have back that I felt like we didn't really maximize. I guess I don't know. I can't answer that one right now. I have to go back and look at some training charts.
Yeah, it's a tough question, and it's funny how some trainers come right out with it, and they say, you know what, there was this one. Boy, this was the one that got away. And then other trainers like you, they'll say, well, there really wasn't. We've been pretty happy with the way all of our horses have performed after we've taken them in. So I'm just curious, being a native of Louisville and growing up so close to Churchill Downs, you mentioned going back there for the meets and how special that is. How many ticket requests are you getting from people saying, hey, can you get me tickets to the Oaks? Can you get me tickets to the Derby?
You do get a lot, you know, the closer it gets, what can you get me, you know, but you do get a lot of people from out of town wanting to know if you can get them tickets, and you can. I mean, it's not an impossible ticket. It's an expensive ticket, but it's not an impossible ticket, so.
Do you have any other family members that are involved in the sport, or is it just you?
No, just me. I have two boys that will probably be involved there. They're really in, you know, they have their iPads. They check charts every day. They check entries. They um, they're very, very sharp, and they know what's going on as far as the horses go. They're very in tune to it. It reminds me a lot of myself. Scary, but it does.
How old are they?
16 and 12.
Oh, okay. So they're at the age where they can come to the barn, and I'm going to assume they help you around the barn?
Yeah, they help out.
Talking with trainer Brad Cox on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So if they've come to you, I'm going to assume maybe the older one has, or maybe they both have, but they come to you and they say, Dad, I want to follow in your footsteps. I want to be a horse trainer. What are you telling them?
Just go to school and get your education first. They're both, you know, obviously one's in high school, one's in middle school, and they're in private school in Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, they do a good job, but, you know, I like to see them go to college. That's one thing I tell them. I said, you know, you need to have something to fall back on and, you know, go to college and get your education. And you know what? If you still want to do this, that's fine. I have no problem with that. You know, if that's the dream you have, then, you know, pursue it. So I don't knock it at all. I don't knock it at all.
Was that the same advice that you got when you were looking to get started, when you talked to your dad and you said, hey, I'm looking at doing this for a living? Did he kind of steer you in that same direction?
Yeah, because he liked the game. He really did. And, you know, obviously he wasn't in it. He wasn't in the business end of it. But, you know, I think he was – he and my mother were very, very happy that I was pursuing something they knew I loved and had a passion for. And when you have a passion or a drive, or it's not even like working. I mean, you know, you get up every day and you enjoy what you do. You know, looking for horses to claim, going to sales. I mean, it's work, but it's something you enjoy. So it's awesome. It's awesome.
All right, Brad, only a few minutes left here before we have to wrap things up here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. But let's get down to the good stuff now. Is it cats or cards for the Cox family?
you ever seen those license plates that say divided house? House divided? That's how it is. I'm a big UK fan. The boys are big Louisville fans. I don't know how they become Louisville fans, but they are, and it's a rivalry to say the least.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you let that happen?
I don't know. I still don't. I don't know. They went to a lot of Louisville baseball games when they were kids, and I think that's how they become big Louisville fans. But I'm a big Kentucky fan. They're big Louisville fans, so it's definitely a house divided.
Well, you've got the bragging rights this year anyways.
Yeah, in basketball anyway.
What else does Brad Cox enjoy doing outside of horse racing when you can get away from the track or you have time to do something else?
I like fishing when I get a chance to do it. I don't get the chance to do it. We went to the lake a few times this summer on a boat and stuff. We like to do things like that, outdoors type things. But we honestly don't get a chance to do much of it because, I mean, obviously on the weekends we're racing. It's kind of weird. On the racetrack, Monday and Tuesday is your dark day, or our weekend, you know, especially in Kentucky because we don't race Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So Mondays and Tuesdays are our weekends. And, you know, we're still working on Monday and Tuesday, obviously. But it's pretty much horse racing 24/7.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. It's 365 days a year. So Thanksgiving, Christmas, you're out there at the barns, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Actually, Churchill, that's one of their bigger days is Thanksgiving Day. So, you know, and there's racing. They have a full card, so that's the way it is.
Well, it's great that you got the support of the family there, too. That's very important. And it sounds like
things
are really on the uptick yet again for trainer Brad Cox. And, Brad, we can't thank you enough for taking the time. I can't thank you enough for being here with me tonight. And all the best moving forward and wish you the best of success.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much, trainer Brad Cox here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Really fun visit and hearing his story coming up, just like so many trainers, getting a start with somebody, whether it was a grandparent or a father, somebody who took them to the racetrack and they just became hooked on the sport. That's how I became hooked on the sport, just going to the track and betting races. And it's a recurring theme that we hear on the show each and every week. But really want to thank our guests for being with us here tonight. Been a lot of fun to hear their stories and take us down the road to where they are today here on Trainer Talk. Don't forget, we're going to take you down the road to the first Saturday in May and all the way through the Triple Crown is your exclusive radio home right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You can visit our website, horseracingradio.net, for a complete broadcast schedule. Don't forget, a podcast of this show also going to be available on our website, horseracingradio.net. That's going to do it for us tonight. Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. We'll talk to you next week here on HRRN.